Missouri poetry is flourishing, if the National Endowment for the Arts is any indicator. In 2017, two fellowships in literature were granted to two women, Hadara Barnadov and Catherine Nuremberger, and New Letters on the Air was able to get them both on stage at the Kansas City Public Library to talk about their poetry. Here's essayist, poet, and former Pleiades Press editor, Catherine Nuremberger.
Mine's all pretty confessional, but I'm like a consummate liar, and I kind of tweak it to make the story good, and then I tell it the good way so much I can't remember anymore. So theoretically, they're all confessional, except if I picked a poem and said, like, what's real in that, is I'd go through and be like, all of it. And then I'd be like, well, wait, that was sort of not exactly like that. And so I'm a lying confessional.
I'm not particularly interested in my truth. I'm interested in the poem's truth. So I might start from a piece of narrative from my life, but wherever the poem takes me is where I'm supposed to go. There are poems that are more clearly tied to my personal life, but that's not my end goal. My end goal is for the poem to tell itself and to tell its story and its truth.
That was Hadara Barnadov, who teaches at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where New Letters on the Air is produced by New Letters Magazine. I'm Angela Elam, and in April 2017, she and Catherine Nuremberger shared their poetry and how they decided to become professional poets, a particularly difficult question for Hadara Barnadov, who's also a painter and musician.
I started out as a slam poet when I was a teenager, and so to me that was professional. My resume was filled with gigs at all these bars in New York where I performed. So that seemed professional, but I wasn't, does professional mean you're making money from it, which I'm still kind of not doing, with the exception of the NEA. And the teaching component certainly overlaps with my creative life, but that's sort of how I think of my professional identity as a teacher. And the poet part is kind of the punk rock devil who, you know, likes to say, I don't care about money, but it would be nice.
What about you, Catherine?
I think I imagined myself to be a poet from the time I was really little, or that not that I was, but that I was going to be a poet. Like, that seemed like a given. Like, I just thought it was a thing you did on the side, or it just happened someday that the muse blessed you, and then you had the poet halo. And so in college, I was a journalism major until they made me start calling people for interviews, and I was super shy, so I dropped out and just became a regular English major. And then I taught high school, but I was a bad high school teacher. So I quit doing that after a couple of years. And so I was working as a nanny in Montana, and I was like, I think I'd better decide I'm a poet right away, or else I'm just a nanny and my life is really in a lot of trouble. So then I just started really taking writing time seriously and reading. You know, I kind of did my own autodidact MFA at the public library in Missoula, Montana for a year until I got into a real program, just reading and writing every day and trying to figure out how you do this thing that I've decided I'm already doing. I crown myself professional because I went to the library one day. That's legit, right?
I also think poetry is probably one of the most honest art forms, if not the most honest art form. And I say that because there really is very, very little money in it. And the only reason you do it is because you're crazy about it and because you're crazy. otherwise, you swallow the logic pill and become a fiction writer, at least, or a screenwriter. Or you become a painter and then you have a something you can sell. So I think it's a very honest art form. You're doing it because you have no choice. The drive is larger than the logic.
Well, Hadara's most recent chapbook is called Fountain and Furnace. So I thought we'd hear Fountain.
So for those of you familiar with the Kansas City area, Fountain was actually inspired by the revealing, semi-pornographic fountains that you can find throughout the plaza. And I can't help but think that whoever the various artists were who worked on the fountains were experimenting, wink, wink, and then getting away also with something that seemed Grecian, or I guess it's based on a city in Spain, Seville. But the fountains are fairly risque. I'm thinking of one where there's a series of frogs peeing on a little boy's penis. Or there's another one where there's a mom peeing into a little boy's mouth. And so if you actually stop and look at these fountains, which we walk by every day without thinking, they're really interesting. Fountain. Dirty, dirty boy, what have you done? Your bath splattered with cigarette butts, leaves, the droppings of doves. No chlorine can clean your iron-eating years. Eyes peeled open, genitals exposed, a mounting rod lodged in the base of your back. Children poke you and steal your pennies. The loose change of your mind emptied by the smallest hands. Who isn't barbaric anymore? The people no longer notice you, bound in stone, charming as a taxidermied swan. Splayed on the plaza square in mid-spring, you wait to be turned on.
Thank you.
That was the poem Fountain from the chapbook called Fountain and Furnace by Hadara Bardadov, and it was the winner of the Sunken Gardens Poetry Prize, which Sunken Gardens are up in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they have a big poetry festival there. Well, I want to just talk a little bit about this chapbook because all of the poems within this have one-word titles. Yep. So talk about what you were after doing that.
Since I was probably 19, 20 years old, I've been reading Gertrude Stein's Tender Buttons on and off, and Frances Ponge, Mute Objects of Expression. So these are poets who have taken on similar projects where they look at a particular object and then explore its inner life, and they're generally inanimate objects. And so my previous book, Lullaby with Exit Sign, was a really traumatic book, a very emotionally difficult book to write about the death of my father and his 25-year illness with Lyme disease. And I needed a break. And so I thought, oh, you know, I'll write about objects and it will be so light and these poems won't hurt, but all good poems come from someplace deep. It doesn't have to be dark, but there's an emotional discharge that happens that I think makes poems kind of rise in a particular way. And what ends up happening, I write a book about the inner lives of objects, thinking I'm going to be safe somehow. And the entire second section of my newest book, The New Nudity, which extends this meditation on objects, is all about the Holocaust. How did that happen? I mean, what comes up, comes up. And that's part of the joy of writing, in a way. There's a discovery.
Why don't you tell the background of your family? Because it is prevalent throughout your work.
So the details on my father's side are a little bit fuzzy, but on my mother's side alone, we had 60 family members who were killed in the Holocaust. And we have very little information on them, basically that they were sent to various concentration camps. Much of my family, I know, was killed in Terezin, and then they just disappear off the face of the planet. I've hid from this material for a long time because it's so deeply painful. And I was also trained, as many children of Holocaust survivors were, to be silent about the Holocaust. It's not something you talk about at all. But it's coming through the poetry anyway. In part for me, poetry is a way of honoring people whose stories are lost, whose lives are lost. And it surprised me in writing a poem about objects, but suddenly I found myself writing these poems about the Holocaust and realized it's in part because these relics that I have are some of the only things I have of these people's lives. So my grandfather's eyeglasses, his pens and pencils, I never knew him, but I have these things that are of him. And when I touch them and see them, I'm connected to him. So in that way, they have an inner life and a story to tell. And to a degree, I've become the holder of many of these family relics. And so I think, without meaning to, again, I was trying to do objects thinking it would be emotionally neutral territory and ended up taking me, you know, to material that's really devastating for me, and I'm sure for other people as well. But, you know, breaking silences, I think, is one of the great gifts of art, and giving voice to those people who were disappeared.
Why don't we have you read a relic poem? This is from The New Nudity, and it contains some of the poetry that's in Fountain and Furnace.
So this poem is called Diamond. My father happened to be a diamond cutter. Diamond. A diamond that hates diamonds, the dumb glittering of the self in the sun. Glitter during war, glitter during plague, glittering terrazin and electric wire. Geometry is the enemy that wounded him and pretended it was love. A head shorn of hair, the object shorn. The diamond ran out of faces, facets, coal, hidden for years in the hem of a stolen coat. I will not trade him for boots, bread, a passport, or the daughter I lost, singing to herself on the other side of the dirt. Each generation chained, charred, glittering, born inside an oven of roiling earth. Light siphoned from my father's bones, crown of white fire.
Diamond, from the book The New Nudity by Hadara Barnadov. And this is New Letters on the Air at the Kansas City Public Library. I've actually interviewed Hadara before, and we've talked some about her poems that had kind of a fairy tale quality, and some about dreams and how you use dreams in your work.
You know, dreams have their own logic that's very similar to poetry, which has its own logic. You can try to impose narrative on it, you can try to impose sense on it, but it often just resists and boycotts that attempt. And dream life is a real gift for the arts. I think visual artists, pianists, I've been given poems and pieces of poems from my dreams, so I think it's important to pay attention to dream life.
Catherine, do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I do. I don't always have dreams, and I've noticed, like, when I'm dreaming, I'm usually writing really well, or things are happening, and when I'm not dreaming, I'm banging my head against the wall, and I don't know if it's causation or correlation, but definitely being able to dream feels really important to being able to write.
I know, Hadara, when we spoke before, you mentioned that in the early morning was a good time for you to write. Is that still true now that you have a little boy?
No. So now it's write whenever you have a chance.
Which is one of the things that is really wonderful about the NEA, because it releases you in a way so that you will have time to do some writing.
Yes. So concentrated writing, versus 10 minutes here, 15 minutes here, an hour, to be able to sit down and just sort of channel and engage and disappear from the world is a tremendous gift. I'm very grateful for it.
Catherine, let me turn to you. Some of the similarities between you two is kind of a fairy tale-ish quality. It's apparent in both of your books of poetry, and I should tell our radio audience that Hadara is very pregnant right now. And your title poem has something to do with pregnancy.
Something to do with it.
Something. So why don't we have you read the title poem? The End of Pink is the name of the book.
I was surprised to learn after I had a baby. No one mentioned this. I don't feel like it's covered in What to Expect, that the hormonal changes turn things that were pink brown. And so I wrote a poem about that. The End of Pink. My nipples are brown now. One way to describe me is mouse-like, like fur on the one decapitated in the silverware drawer this morning. Once we set a trap for a mouse so fat the hinge could do no more than pinch his neck contorted. For hours he clinked around the spoons. If you survive your own execution, the only justice is that you be permitted to walk away with your decapitated head in your hands, as St. Denis did, up the hill into the chapel of the rest of his life, where we would come to eat sandwiches on a bench, holding hands as we would when we took the mouse to a grassy lot in the alley behind the First Presbyterian. Because a hawk noticed and became restless on his branch, we stood guard watching the mouse try to organize himself. It's disgusting to touch a rodent, so we used tongs to straighten the sideways spine trapped so unaccountably wrong. The fat creature limped himself into the yellow grass and further. The bird moved on, and we went home to dinner happy, knowing happy for the mouse was unlikely. But then so was Dennis. How wide-eyed he must have been. When I told Brian about my nipples, he told me a little joke. A boy was in a terrible accident. He finally woke in the hospital and cried, "Doctor, I can't feel my legs." The doctor was reassuring. "Of course you can't. We had to amputate your arms." Sorry, she made me read it.
Well, at least nobody walked out when you mentioned nipples. Didn't you have that happen? Oh, no, it was another poem I read somewhere that you had the word vagina in a poem and somebody walked out.
Kansans are tough crowds.
That's the title poem, The End of Pink, by Katherine Nuremberger, winner of the James Lachlan Award in 2015. Talk a little bit about this collection.
Sure. At the end of the first book, I've been writing a lot about cabinets of curiosities, and so I was already kind of on a trajectory into researching the history of science and medicine, and I already had lots of notes about weird stuff that happened to people in the 19th century when they thought your womb was just floating around everywhere. And so it was like super convenient that I had a couple pregnancies and had a baby. And that's insane, right? I mean, your womb isn't floating around everywhere, but it kind of feels like it is. And it certainly sometimes seems like your doctors don't know what's happening or why, and they try out all kinds of things. So I don't know, I felt a little hysterical, and I felt like I was sometimes in the care of people who believed in hysteria, and it all came pouring out in these weird poems with weird facts and weird theories.
I know, really. There are all these scientific facts, like scientists trying to put heads that don't belong on certain monkeys on other monkeys or something like that, that you're intrigued with.
It's really interesting to me to see other people trying to understand difficult or unanswerable questions. And so looking at the history of medicine and seeing the language that they were using to try to kind of come to some new understanding. I mean, electricity, there were big questions in the 18 and 1700s about, like, is it wet? Like, because it flows. Like, is it a liquid or is it a fire? What are we going to call it? I think Benjamin Franklin called it the ethereal fire for a while. So there's like all this language that to us seems really beautiful because it didn't move forward. So it just sounds incredibly metaphorical, but it also was like so sincere to them. And so that disconnect between concept and what language can explain feels very poetic. And I like to just dive in and borrow that from them.
Well, tell people a little bit about the Bakken Museum, because you had a fellowship there.
So. I did, yeah. They had like a whole exhibit with Leyden jars. I mean, this is part of the thing with those electricity water is you can have a completely empty jar that will be filled up with static electricity inside it, and then you can like use copper hooks. It makes a little battery. And the outside part of the museum, I was like hanging out with the eight-year-olds being like, oh my gosh, I get it. I totally get it. But then in the basement, they had this huge medical library because the founder of the museum was the guy that invented the pacemaker, so he was super excited.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's how they had funding for all this. And so he had a personal library from the history of medicine. So there was like a cute, kitschy little museum out in front that was full of kids on field trips, and then I was like hanging out in the back in the secret room with the weird books. Oh, this Italian guy in the 1700s when they were first finding electricity was like making frogs twitch and stuff and then make people's eyes pop open for a crowd. And it was for science, so it wasn't. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Well, do you have something you'd like to read connected with that?
Oh, let's see. Something horrifying? I mean, probably. More experiments with the mysterious property of animal magnetism.
Oh, there you go.
That one was sort of coming out of a lot of that material.
Let's do that one.
This is the title of one of the books I was reading. More experiments with the mysterious properties of animal magnetism, 1769. Finding myself in a mesmeric orientation, before me appeared Benjamin Franklin, who magnetized his French paramours at dinner parties as an amusing diversion from his most serious studies of electricity and the ethereal fire. I like thinking about how he would have stood on tiptoe to kiss their buzzing lips, and everyone would gasp and clap for the blue spark between them. I believe in an honest and forthright manner, a democracy of plain speech, so I have to find a way to explain I don't care to have sex anymore. Once I was a high school teacher, and there was a boy who came in late, who only came to school at all to sell drugs out of his backpack, upon which he laid his head like a pillow and closed his eyes while I pointed at a chart diagramming the anatomy of a sparrow. The vice principal was watching and taking notes as I taught this class, so I slid the bag from under his cheek as if not to wake him, wrapped his fingers around a pen. I was trying to be a gentle mother and also trying to show I was in control of an unstable situation. The boy, also trying to be in control of himself, walked so slow to my desk, and we stood to watch him push everything, binders, piles of ungraded papers, a beaker of red pens to the floor. He was so calm. How do you like it when I touch your things? I do not like it. I live in a house with many blue mason jars, each containing a feather collection or starfish collection or vertebrae collection, and also there is a fully articulated fetal alligator skeleton. Each window is pressed by the design of a sweet gum branch, all the little orange and red stars of its leaves. You can't see the perfect geometry this close, just haphazard parabolas, but beneath the foundation, the roots mirror the branching. I have a chart of this to pull down. The view is flat and so quiet on the inside. Have I been forthright yet? What I want to know is what happens if I decide to never have sex again. Or more precisely, can I decide to not have sex again and still be kind and be a joy to others? I should mention I'm a wife. I should have mentioned I was told my sole purpose is to be joy to others. The sidewalks outside are very full of people, and when I look at them, I feel hopeless. Benjamin Franklin was so jolly with his kite and his key and his scandalous electricity. He was so in love with women and drink and democracy. Before I was this way, I was not a house. I was just a jar, and what I wanted was to be broken. A cool trick you can do that I once showed a class is crank a wheel covered in felt against another felt wheel. Static bristles and sparks and makes your hair stand on end. But hook it to a Leyden jar and the electricity fills up in there, invisible as air, becomes a glass battery until you do too much the thing, then wow, broken glass everywhere. I remember wanting that. Do I have to always want that? My house is blue and quiet. I can hardly hear the squirrel in my sweet gum tree dancing like a sunbeam to sing his riddles. A house full, a hole full, but you cannot gather a bowl full. The air of everywhere is wet with electric fluid. You can't even tell, but pop whiz everywhere. In this field, Ben says, the soul has room enough to expand, to display all of her extravagances. The sweet gum has 10,000 sticky, spiky seed balls. They start green, but grow black and fall for want of a barren season. They look like sea urchins. I call them tree urchins and think it's a funny joke. I don't tell it to anyone, as I am tired of being told what is not. Such a secret, I know, is an extravagance, and I like best how it's an extravagance so small you must keep it in a jar with others of its kind for it to ever mean anything at all. Okay.
The title of that is More Experiments with the Mysterious Property of Animal Magnetism, 1769, from the collection The End of Pink, winner of the James Lachlan Award, and it's by Catherine Nuremberger. And this is New Letters on the Air at the Public Library on the Plaza. And we'll talk a bit about what makes poetry, because Hadara is the co-author, along with Michelle Boisseau, of the best-selling textbook called Writing Poems. It's in its eighth edition now, and you take apart different types of poetry. How would you describe that particular poem? I would almost say a prose poem, but it doesn't go all the way to the sides of the page. I know you haven't looked at it, so I'm putting you on the spot. I'm speaking to Hadara now.
I have read the book, but I don't remember the form of it offhand. I guess one of the things I observed about it was its interweaving of narratives, which I think was really just wonderful and fantastical. I don't know that I'd go fairy tale on this one, but
no,
fantastical.
Not.
I talk to my students often about poems as building a universe that the readers can walk into and experience for themselves. And that poem is truly one that you can walk into and see the glittering world all around you. A pleasure to hear out loud.
Thanks. Well, when you are helping your students, and both of you teach poetry,
Sometimes I use Sadara's textbook and Michelle's textbook.
Yeah. Oh, do you really?
Oh, yeah, it's great. They make things that seem impossible to explain seem actually very simple after you read their explanations.
What was the moment of discovery in writing poems for you that was something that you hadn't really thought about before?
Do you remember? Well, I think what Hadara was just saying about building worlds really resonates with my students.
I have heard a poet say, if you have intention, write an essay. if you're interested in discovery, then write a poem. And I don't know that I would come down so hard, you know, such a hard line between genres in that way. Certainly there's the lyric essay, which blurs the line between poetry and essay, and I write essays as well and think they can be very creative. But it's a really difficult concept to relay to writers early in their careers, that when they have an idea, that will often screw them up as they're writing, because they're not engaged in discovery. They're not attending to the language and the sound and where that is taking them. And there's so much discovery and joy to be found in using sound or image or form as a compositional device. And to decide that this is what the poem is going to look like, and it's going to be in this box, and it's going to do this and make people feel this way, sort of cuts you off at the pass before you even get started in that realm of discovery. So I say intent is wonderful if it gets you started, and then put it aside and let the poem arise.
Yeah, I think figuring out intent is sort of part of the pleasure that we give the readers, right? Like what you were saying earlier about dreams and the importance of dreams in the process too. And it feels like when I'm writing, I need to somehow stay in a little bit of like more of a dreamy state. There's like a gut check thing where this feels right, but I don't always know how to articulate that. And then when it's done, I guess I could go back and read myself like I would read some other poet and articulate what I was doing, but that seems vain. But then I spend a lot of time figuring out other poets' intent and trying to internalize what they're doing and why it worked. And I like to think that that's building a certain kind of muscle memory that helps my gut check on when a poem is saying something worth saying, but I don't like to think too much about my intent because I like to be surprised by the process. Like, that's where the pleasure is for me.
It's one of the great joys, right? There might come a point in the revision process where I'm trying to figure out what the poem is saying and where it's going that it becomes more cerebral, but I would probably use the word sculpting versus intent. A sense of where the poem is going, a sense of the poem as a system in which certain things fit into that system and certain things don't. So in the revision process, it can become more cerebral. But also one of the joys of the revision process is to revisit that point of creativity and inspiration that first brought the poem to you, so then you're off again in outer space and that whatever comes, comes.
So as soon as you figure out your intent, then all of a sudden it's like a...
You're gone.
Slips away once more. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we'll wrap it up there. You guys have been a wonderful audience.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And let's give a round of applause to the library, too.
Thank you.
You just heard two NEA Fellows in Literature, Hadara Barnadov and Catherine Nuremberger, recorded at the Kansas City Public Library in 2017 with support from the English Department and Women's Studies at UMKC. Since then, Hadara's book, The New Nudity, has been published with acclaim, and Catherine Nuremberger, author of The End of Pink, has moved from the University of Central Missouri to the University of Minnesota, but will be back in Kansas City to read for the 2019 Midwest Poet Series and talk with us about her recent essay collection, Brief Interviews with the Romantic Past. For links, visit newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Dylan Cramhorn, Danny Reeves, Justin Garnett, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.